Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from an undisclosed location in the Jersey Shore in an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew Gundling, JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
What's up is that you are a committed man to be doing this on your vacation, but we haven't missed a week in how many years now?
7.5.
It's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Not once. And not only, first off, I will say thank you. And second off, I would say you're committed as well, because you have just rode out a hurricane. Have you not?
Yes. It was unbelievable levels of water. I was over on Eastern Parkway, not far from where one of the stairs at the close to the museum became a waterfall. Today, Brooklyn will have waterfalls. There was some incredible flooding down towards the Gowanus Canal in my neighborhood. Anyone who knows Brooklyn will know that that canal, you don't want that thing flooding. You want it to stay where it is. You don't want it rising up. It was pretty incredible. I got pretty soaked. But thankfully, none of the high dangerous winds that caused the real problems. We did not get any of that.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear. I'm glad to hear you're safe. I hope everybody listening in the Northeast is safe, not dealing with water damage or any of the effects of Hurricane Henri, JJ.
Yeah, indeed. Henri. Yeah. A perfect name for a tropical storm, I think.
I guess so. So we got a lot to get to today here to look back on this weekend. A lot happened. We're going to talk, of course, about Arsenal and Chelsea. I know it seems like you have some stuff you want to talk about with Everton and Leeds in what was a fun one. And then there were scenes in Ligue 1, and I feel bad kind of only parachuting. Like, we don't talk a ton of Ligue 1, and I feel bad just parachuting in when something bad happens. But I'm curious, by now people have probably seen the events that transpired between Nice and Marseille, and we're going to talk about it in a little bit. I am extremely curious to see how this will be handled. And I'll talk about why a little bit later on in the podcast, because this could be a potentially interesting outcome. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on it as well. So we've got a lot to do. Also, Cristiano Ronaldo, I guess. Will he be transferred? Will he not be? Are the rumors legitimate? Are they nonsense? It's all very fluid. So we'll talk about that. There's a lot to do. Let's get right into it, though, with the Premier League from over the weekend, JJ, and the marquee matchup that took place Sunday afternoon. Arsenal and Chelsea. Chelsea continue to look like the defending European champions that they are, and Arsenal continue to look like the defending eighth place side that they are, JJ.
Well, we hope they look like an eighth place side, or at least Arsenal fans do. I'm not so sure.
Wow. So you're saying I'm actually maybe over the top in my praise.
I don't know. They've lost to a newly promoted side, that didn't even have to play that well to beat them. And they've lost to the champions in a game that was pretty much over by the 35th minute, or at least it felt that way. I think Arsenal are in a spot that they have not been in 25 years. And it's very, very strange. We've seen, you know, poor Arsenal seasons. The last few under Wenger, okay, but this feels different. And I think the variable here is that you knew what Arsene Wenger eventually would do. You know, there would be some sort of steadying of the ship. Mm-hmm. And it always seemed to happen. You know, their course was corrected and they kind of stayed in contention, or kind of in the top half of the table at least. But now we're in uncharted waters, because we have a manager who is a rookie manager, and we do not know how this is going to play out. And he came in for some serious criticism. It was unbelievable to listen to Lee Dixon, a doyen of great Arsenal teams, talk about something like how poor the Arsenal press was, how everybody wasn't doing their job and wasn't doing what they should be. He was saying how disjointed it was. He said, all right, one person goes to press there, then the next guy behind is, you know, half-hearted, and then someone else isn't even trying. And this was after 20 minutes of the game. And, you know, if Mikel Arteta can't get his team to do something as I won't say simple, but as basic. You know, if you're a team that's going to press, then everyone has to do it with the same level of enthusiasm and with the same, you know, just know what you're supposed to be doing. And if you can't get them to do that and it's that noticeable, not good at all. And I know I'm ranting here, but one more thing as well. The left side of Arsenal's defence, or the left side of the team, really, the way Chelsea targeted, went down that right side. You know, no correction from...
You're talking about the Kieran Tierney side?
Yeah, the Kieran Tierney side. Like,
they were overwhelming him.
They knew he's going to get forward. He's going to link the play with the forward players. A lot of overloads are going to have to happen in that area for Arsenal to take, you know, attack-wise. And Thomas Tuchel just said, okay, right, well, then we're going to overload on that side and we're going to put balls in behind and create massive problems for you. And they did. And it was as if Arteta didn't know what to do then. Bleak day for Arsenal.
Yeah, I would mostly agree. Now, there's a couple things. I'm not trying to mount a defense for Arsenal because I agree with everything you're saying.
No, but this is classic you. This is what you do, though.
First of all, don't you dare put this on me. You're one of the great contrarians this world has ever seen. All right. I will say this on behalf of Arsenal fans who are right now listening to this and saying all they ever do is just crud on our team. I'm tired of this. Here's what I will say. If we're going to be fair and lay out a full picture, for one, I thought that Arsenal had earned a penalty at the end of the first half. If that's given, who knows? Maybe it's a different game. I don't think it is. Chelsea clearly looked like the better team to me, but this is a weird sport and they should have had a penalty. I'll give them that. And I'll say it's not like they didn't generate any chances. Rob Holding probably should have scored on a header from a corner kick in the second half. Near post, got to it in time, just missed it. So I'll say that. Now, the reason I don't want to go too deep on defending them in those ways in terms of chances created is because the Arsenal that you're talking about that we're used to under Wenger are not relying on just two opportunities basically to score goals. Like, you know, in this sport, if you have nine chances, maybe you score two goals. You can't rely on just getting two or three opportunities and scoring from them all. That's just not how soccer works. So I'm not going to go too deeply on that. The other way in which I will defend them a little bit, and I think this one is a little bit more legitimate, has a little bit more validity to it, is that I think the Arsenal team that we're seeing today or yesterday during that game isn't necessarily the Arsenal team that we're going to see in a few weeks. I think they were without a lot of key players, not just like a couple. I think like enough that it would cause a substantial difference, especially when you're playing against a team as good as Chelsea. So be down on them right now, certainly, because what you're seeing right now tactically, what you're seeing right now in terms of depth, bad. But in terms of making a full judgment of what this team is going to be this season, I don't know if we can do that just yet.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I don't think the Arsenal fans were listening. I mean, they're all aware of the problems with missing players, the problems with COVID within the club. They're all aware of that, the Arsenal fans, and they still decided that they would boo at halftime.
Yeah, you know, within the context of a game, that's what I've come to expect from fans. They're not happy with what they're seeing, and they're not going to really take the time to think about, you know, who's not here. Like, we're watching a game. That was bad. I'm going to boo now. I get that.
But I think they do. They have, like, young players that I would be, you know, excited about, that they've got a bit about them. Mm-hmm. You know, Emile Smith Rowe, I think he's got a lot of talent.
Yeah.
I think, you know, obviously Saka. But it's just, I don't know. I just don't see enough progress under Arteta generally, even when everyone's fully there. And in the first game of the season, I asked a question, and I think Roy Keane seized upon it. Have you got Roy Keane's quotes there from Sky at the weekend?
I do have one quote where he's talking about their defending.
Yeah, because I asked the question, and Roy clearly follows my Twitter because we know he's a social media fiend. But I said, when did Arsenal become soft? Like, what was the year or even the game where Arsenal stopped being tough and became soft? Like, you knew you could get at them. Even average teams could get at them. There was a moment where we flipped away from the old remnants of like the Adams and Keown's and the Saul Campbells, and we clicked over and suddenly Arsenal were soft.
Yeah. What Roy Keane said was, he said, Arsenal are decent going forward, but part of football is defending and there's a softness to them. That's not a quick fix for your young players might get you out of jail the odd time, but long-term there's a long way back for Arsenal. I mean, he's talking about like a cultural change needs to occur there, which does not necessarily right. occur with one, you know, with Ben White, you know, like, I don't think that's
Ben White. I don't mean to be zeitgeist changer.
Right. And look, you could see it. I mean, we'll talk about the Chelsea side of this, of course, but that first goal, I mean, the way Romelu Lukaku just swatted back Pablo Mari like he was some kind of, like he was a gnat, not even a fly, a gnat. I mean, that's like, you're facing Lukaku. You just, I know it's easy for me to sit here and say, be stronger. Like, it's not, you can't just snap your fingers. Oh, I'm stronger now. But like, you have to come at it with like a different mental perspective of what Lukaku is and what he's about. And for Mari to just be,
or don't get so close that you know, because the way he is, he loves to roll players and don't do that. Sit off a bit, do something different. You know, it's as if they were seeing Lukaku for the first time. And that's another thing as well. Did the manager not have a specific plan for European football's, you know, most potent striker last season? You know, did they not talk about what he'll do, the things he'll do, and how we'll combat them? It just seemed, again, soft. And
I wonder, JJ, if they were surprised that he was playing. I was a little bit surprised. I figured he'd be on the bench, but I was a little surprised when I saw him in the starting 11.
Yeah, maybe that's actually a good point. Maybe that's what happened, but even still.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk also about Arsenal's young players, and that actually, I saw this from Graham Souness, which I actually thought was a good point. And he's talking about Bukayo Saka, and, you know, because we've been exposed to Saka for a while and we've seen him with England, we don't necessarily view him as what he is, a child, a small child. He's 19 still. And Souness points this out. He said, Saka is arguably Arsenal's main man. Is that a mark of where Arsenal are at this moment in time, relying on a 19-year-old to be the difference in games? In an ideal scenario, you would want a 19-year-old coming in, a settled team that is successful, but that's not the case for Arsenal. Saka is expected to turn up every week and be the difference. You know, that I was trying to think of other examples of super young players who have a world of talent, but like Phil Foden at Manchester City, you know, like, he's not expected to come in and be there. You know, well, if we don't have Phil Foden, we're in trouble. Like, that's not going to be the case for him. That's a settled side that he can come in and like do his thing and grow. And, you know, you wonder about Smith Rowe, Saka, huge expectations. And so far they've done an admirable job in fulfilling them at such young ages, but it's in terms of like now also wanting them to lead Arsenal up the table from where they've been, it is asking a lot. With guys like Aubameyang are not going to perform up to what we expect them to be, and you know, Lacazette right now is obviously out. You know, it's putting a lot on guys who are teenagers still to lead Arsenal. You know, that's like you said last week about them. They're a superpower. Even if in this moment they're not, they're a giant of the sport. And to tell a 19-year-old, okay, now we were eighth, that's not good enough, go get us into the Champions League. Like, you're asking an awful lot of kids.
Allow me to go full Roy Keane and say that they have done something like this before. They've never been afraid to like blood talented youngsters. We saw when Cesc Fabregas making his debut, what was he, 16, 17, and came in and then became a mainstay really, really quickly. But he was surrounded by, as Mr. Keane would say, senior pros, you know, characters. That's not the case at Arsenal. He's not coming into a place where there's a ton of, you know, leaders or anything of that nature. There's a lot of senior pros there, okay, but they have not been successful for Arsenal. And yeah, there's a huge weight on his shoulders.
Yeah, like Raheem Sterling at Liverpool when he came up. You know, like, there was, I mean, you had what, Gerrard, Suarez, I mean, was
he
there.
Right. But he was important, but he was never, like you said, there was a sharing of the load. There was Gerrard, there was even like you had, say, like Agger at the back, Carragher was in the side when Raheem Sterling came in. So yeah, it doesn't feel like that at Arsenal. Right. And by the way, Raheem Sterling did not come into a great Liverpool side by any means, but like within what, a season and a half, you know, they were competing for the title under Brendan Rodgers. This is different at Arsenal.
Yeah, I agree. Do you have more on Arsenal, or should we get to the victors from this game?
Not really. I don't have a ton on Chelsea, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't either. A couple things. First off, I at least wanted to talk about Lukaku. I know we kind of mentioned him there, but like there's hitting the ground running, and then there's that we saw yesterday. That was a great performance from a guy who just jumped back into the league. And I guess what I would say is I'm actually not shocked by that. A, because I think very highly of him as a player. He's great. We know that. And B, you know, sometimes we talk about strikers and kind of needing, like, if you're not from this league, you know, sometimes we see guys who are good elsewhere that come to the Premier League and they're just not as good right away. You can even look at Chelsea and Timo Werner as a guy who struggled throughout the course of last season. Lukaku's not going to be that guy. He knows this league like the back of his hand. So yeah, he's in his prime. Like, I think Chelsea got exactly what they thought they'd be getting yesterday, and I see no reason why it doesn't continue. He scored a goal, probably should have had two, if not for a great save from Bernd Leno. 8 shots, 11 touches in the box, the most of anyone in the game. So here we go. I mean, if you thought highly of Chelsea before, I think you got a taste yesterday of how good they could potentially be moving forward with him.
Yeah, I one thing I liked about Chelsea again was their width. I thought Reece James was excellent, and he took his goal tremendously well. Like what a confident, brilliant finish. But I know they've got a game coming up against Liverpool, which will be much, much tougher. But that was very, very easy for Chelsea. And yeah, I know they got a bit of luck with a penalty that is a stonewall penalty last season, but under the new directions is just not a penalty this season. It's a coming together. It's a, you know, a dangling leg that was caught. They're not going to give those penalties, although I kind of feel like it should have been one. And that might have changed things a little bit, but I still think Chelsea were so uber comfortable in this game. And that's an indictment on Arsenal. For what's supposed to be a derby, it never felt like that.
Yeah. One other thing, you talked about Reece James, who I wanted to mention. Yeah, I thought he's what he can provide Chelsea is really dangerous. We talked about Lukaku. I did want to say one thing on the Reece James goal, because, you know, Reece James obviously is going to get the plaudits for it. But the job on the opposite side of the field before it even got to James that Kai Havertz did, I mean, he's got two guys on him and he's up against he's like right up against the line of being out of bounds. And for him, like, he kind of just backheels it. I forget who it was to, but he just like gets out of this jam and gets the ball back into space with this backheel. It's perfectly placed and it set up the whole goal. And I was so impressed by it, watching it in real time, not even thinking, okay, a goal is about to happen here, but just the fact that he was able to keep play alive and keep Chelsea in possession. And then sure enough, they're good enough where it led directly to a goal. You know, he's someone that if we're talking about potential X factors moving forward in this season, like he last season, whether it was due to, like we're talking about, coming from a new league into the Premier League, if it was because of his early battles with COVID, you know, there was a change of manager. They spent a lot on him. And in the end, it worked out. Obviously, he scored the goal in the Champions League to win it. But overall, Kai Havertz probably didn't deliver what Chelsea thought exactly they'd be getting. And if he does turn into the player that they think, and you add to that now this collection of talent around them, Lukaku coming in, you know, other young players like Reece James now becoming stars, like Havertz is the one to me that can maybe take them to an even greater level, where it's like, you know, we've looked at Man City on kind of this level and then Chelsea maybe are a tick below them. Maybe it's more even than we realize if some of these players like him turn out to be what we think they can be.
I would agree with that. And you know, I'm not trying to say that the other players are not extremely talented, but you talked about X Factor today. I do think that Kai Havertz has much more, like he is a much more rounded player than any of the other attackers that Chelsea have. And if he hits form and starts doing the things which we can see him doing already, he's going to be huge for them. And we'll soon forget that last season was a struggle for him too.
Yeah. One other thing on Chelsea. We have to do this, JJ.
Oh my God.
We have to do this. So Christian Pulisic, I'm going to approach this from two. This is a two-pronged attack. The first prong of this is I'm going to approach this as a human being. The human being in me feels terrible for this guy. I hope he's okay. He was diagnosed with positive for COVID, even though he said he's been vaccinated. still tested positive, which we know breakthrough cases can occur. My hope, I haven't heard anything, but my hope is that he's asymptomatic, which I think up to this point he is, that he's feeling fine. You know, and along with that, I just feel terrible for him because this is another kind of stop and start to his career where it looked like things are going well. He scored a goal last week. He's in the starting 11 for Chelsea's first game. And bang, now he's got COVID and he's out 10 days. And it just seems to be following this pattern from his career. The FA Cup final, scores a goal, tears his hamstring. Like, it's just this, we see this repeatedly. And I feel terrible for him because I can't imagine how frustrating this sort of thing continues to be. I'm sure when that positive test came back, you know, he probably just looked up to the sky and just thought, like, why does this keep happening? I'm sure he's beyond words frustrated. The human being in me, I feel terrible for him. And I hope he gets well as soon as possible. Now, of course, the other side of this, we know, JJ, fans are not human beings. Fans are cyborgs that were put on this planet for no other reason than to feel happy or angry with the performance of their team and their players, and they feel no actual human emotion. So the fan in me looked at this also and thought, oh, well, this is interesting timing, given the fact that the U.S. World Cup qualifying begins on September 2nd. And so I pulled up an article here at The Athletic from Paul Tenorio and Sam Stescal, and they basically break this down. So they say, according to UK government and COVID-19 policies, Pulisic must now isolate for 10 days. If he remains asymptomatic for the duration of his isolation period, he will be allowed to return to normal activities at 11:59 p.m. August 28th. So basically August 29th. If he develops symptoms before then, he will have to begin a new 10-day isolation period that will start from the day following the onset of symptoms. In that scenario, Pulisic will almost certainly miss most, if not all, of the upcoming international window. So this is kind of hanging in the balance. I would say even if he does not develop symptoms, if August 29th is when he can begin to reacclimate into society, I mean, I guess he can, you know, they say here, if he's allowed to resume normal activities on the 28th, he'll be permitted under both UK and US guidelines to travel to Nashville in time for the start of US men's national team camp on August 30th. But JJ, remember, he will not really have done anything for essentially a week and a half, almost 2 weeks. And now you're talking about asking him to go into El Salvador for that first World Cup qualifier. Then they have Canada just a couple days later on September 5th, and then another tough one at Honduras, September 8th. So I don't know. As it stands right now, my best guess is I don't know. I think he'll probably, if he's asymptomatic, he'll probably be able to take part in some way, but don't be looking for him to be playing three games, 90 minutes. I'd say 0% chance of anything even close to that.
No, the big thing is he can't do group training. So we know what he's like. He'll be training like an animal on his own, doing whatever he can. But the issue with that is that is not training in the group, and then to throw him into these three games in quick succession. The last thing he wants then is to have a niggling injury coming out of that.
Right.
Misses more time with Chelsea, replaced in the lineup, which we know how quickly and easily that can happen. So best case scenario is that he gets there, he can participate somewhat, but that his minutes are managed to the nth degree, and he comes out of this three-game run, which is so tight. Thursday, Sunday, Tuesday. Travel as well included in that, you know, two away games and one home game. It's incredible. And it's another layer of difficulty being added to World Cup qualifying, that these windows are so tight. But yeah. We don't know, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah. And part of the humbling that we've undergone as American fans is, like, people outside of CONCACAF will look at really all three of those, but I'm talking for away game purposes. I'm just looking right now at El Salvador and Honduras as the two road fixtures that the U.S. have. And people outside of this region will kind of be like, oh, okay, well, like, so you won't have them for those two. That should still be 6 points. Oh, maybe you're right. But those of us here who have experienced those features, those fixtures, and who have been humbled in the last four or five years, I do not take those for granted in the least. Those are some of the most extreme conditions that you can play in from kind of a hostility standpoint from the fan base that you're playing in front of. So yeah, that's not nothing to be losing him for at El Salvador and at Honduras. And I guess if you're looking at what they'll do if he can't play, the one good thing that has come from the last, you know, couple years with the U.S. is that they've been really able to blood in a lot of new young players. And I think it's kind of next man up. Like, I think, okay, Brendan Aaronson, like, he can play on that side and he's played well for the U.S. And so I think, you know, if they want to do a like for like, I think they can. I think it's him, and I would feel good about it. Not as good, obviously, if Pulisic was there. He's our best player, but still good enough that I think the U.S. can go in and win. And
no,
I think Aaronson can play well.
I don't. You don't have to go to these lengths to explain, Andrew. I totally agree with you. We said this ad nauseum on the podcast. Yeah, we've got all these players. We've got these really good, talented players. But guess what? This is difficult. This is a different system of qualifying than we've had before with the tight three-game window. Also, we have players who are back now full-time for their clubs. There's going to be injuries. We're not going to have everyone all the time. So we have to get on with it. Just get on with it. Simple as that.
Let's see. We move on now, JJ, to Everton and Leeds. And a real fun one at Elland Road.
Yeah, this... When you see this fixture on the calendar, you think this just classic Premier League fixture. I don't know why that is. There's a show on Sky TV called Premier League Years, and it basically goes back every season and goes through the major events of what happened that season, interspersed with world news of world events of that happened in that particular season too.
Is this on YouTube?
Yeah, you can get them on YouTube, and yeah, but they just run them. They're like filler on a Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock, Premier League years, 97, 98.
Right. It's like when I'm watching a Phillies game and they go into a rain delay and it's like, okay, now it's yearbook 2002.
Yeah. But I mean, and these are really fun. And you sit there and you go, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh my God, what a goal that was. And, you know, some kind of controversy comes up. And Everton Leeds would be one of those games. It's just a classic. And this was really good. And I hope people got to watch this one, because this was one where you're like, ah, no, that's what a full Elland Road is like. That is what a good traveling away support from Everton is like. That's what noise is like at the start of the game. From the kickoff, there was a roar at Elland Road. Like, it was, and when Rafinha scored the equalizer, it was amazing. Absolutely. And this game had a bit of bite about it. You know, these are two teams that, of similar kind of standing in terms of their place in the English game historically. And they just got stuck into each other. They fed off the vibes from the crowd. This was a nice one, a very good game too. And I don't know. I think 2-2 was a fair enough result.
Well, even beyond what you just said is interesting, that they, you know, their historic place in the game. I think even beyond, that's like the, what is it? That would be macro. The micro would be within the confines of this season. I sort of feel like these two teams probably believe they're battling for similar real estate as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. Even though, as much as I want to think that Leeds are, I was more optimistic about Leeds kicking on this season. I think the first two games would suggest that maybe that kicking on is going to take a little bit longer and there's going to be more tweaking needed. But yeah, you're right. That's absolutely true. And, I don't know. There was little things from this game that, if I'm an Everton fan, you know, they had chances to solidify that lead at 2-1 that were not taken. But more than that, a couple of the signings where you're like, okay, we'll see how this works out. Like, I thought Damari Gray had a great game.
Yeah.
Like, I thought he had a really good game, and he looks like a solid piece of business. And I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We do a jump to conclusions week in the third week of the Premier League, so I don't want to step all over that. But I think a home win against Southampton to start your Everton managerial career, and then to go to Elland Road and get a point, is not a bad start for Senor Benitez.
Does he? I have not taken the temperature of my Everton fan friends. How quickly before, like, because, you know, we talked about how they felt about that appointment. Overall, the majority were not happy with it. I wonder how long it takes for him to get them on side. Has he already?
Onside. Okay. What does that mean? Like, they're not,
will they start chanting his name in a positive way, Andrew, in Goodison?
No. Do you think they're going to do the Rafael Benitez? They're going to copy the Liverpool song or something? That may never happen. Never.
It wouldn't be any kind of like middle finger to Liverpool. Like, if they take that and make it theirs,
they will sing it if they win a trophy, a major trophy. That's what it would take.
All right. So you're right. That was extreme. I apologize. So, okay. Short of chanting his name, just like, you know, you're in a pub outside of Goodison before a match and it's like an Everton old head and a young guy. And they're talking and they're like, I'll tell you what, maybe I was wrong about Rafa. Like, when will that happen?
No, but it's not about being wrong or right about Rafa. For a lot of the supporters, the taint, the stench, the stank of Kopite is on him and shall never be cleansed from his soul unless he goes on the heath and have witches dance around him, you know, with sage. Okay. I mean, it's going to take some kind of, you know, medieval ritual to get rid of that stank. That stank doesn't go away. So you're not going to hear them say, I was wrong about Rafa. What they will say is that he's got us playing ball, or we're much more organized, or we're X or Y. It'll be on a tactical level, not on that kind of emotional level.
So you're saying that they can never do anything more than tolerate him? I don't buy that.
Are you listening to me? They can do more than tolerate him, but he has to do something beyond, and that beyond would be to win a major trophy. That is what he would have to do to take that next step. And by the way, he did that as interim manager for Chelsea, and they still hated him at Stamford Bridge because of that rivalry that developed for a period in the mid-2000s between Liverpool and Chelsea. So that's how it goes.
Fascinating. I mostly agree with you about Everton. I think, you know, if you were an Everton fan, we talked about the Athletic's morale table. Everton was, they were rooted to the bottom of fan morale coming into the season. I would think they're probably up to about 13th in that table now. I would think fans are starting to feel better. I mean, there's certainly signs from this game. Look, what happened on the first Leeds goal, Michael Keane, you expect better from, just took a poor angle on it, slipped, slow to react.
That's two mistakes in two games, Andrew. He's, like anyone who listens to this podcast knows I don't rate him very highly, but you know, Rafa kind of creating organization, making players better. He's got a job on with Michael Keane in the start he's made to the season. It was so weird. You're right. He got like square to the ball and out of position and he couldn't turn.
Yeah.
It was, you know, those memes that came out when, was it Jerome Boateng got absolutely minced by Lionel Messi?
Right. And then people like have a video of him disappearing off the screen almost, or falling into a hole or, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That Michael Keane did that to himself.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, there's certainly still things there. Like, you're right. Everton probably feel like they should have won that game and they didn't. So they'll still have reason to kind of have concerns with this team. But like, you know, when we were talking before the season and you kind of challenged me and you were like, okay, be positive to an Everton fan, like find something positive. And I think the thing that we both looked at holds true in that their young players are just now hitting their prime. And I think you're starting to see it a little bit. I mean, obviously, you know, Richarlison is a really good player, but a guy like Dominic Calvert-Lewin, I mean, what is he, only 24? I think he's only getting better. They have guys who have not touched their ceilings yet. And so, you know, hopefully that alone with maybe overachieving a little bit in the way of some of their signings in ways that we didn't expect with Gray, it could be better than whatever Everton fans thought it was going to be.
I agree with you.
We continue now. JJ, Manchester United go to Southampton, come away with just a 1-1 draw, getting a 54th minute goal from Mason Greenwood to at least get 1 point from it. Not the same United that we saw a week ago?
No, not the same United. Actually, the same United, but a different opposition. And I did say that the first time that they would meet a team that could... that wouldn't do the things that Leeds did, they would struggle. And, you know, at times, it was interesting because our respective opinions of United, you know, your opinion of Paul Pogba was vindicated in this game because anything good that happened, the creativity, there was a purple patch in the second half, about 15 minutes where United looked good and they looked like they'd press on and maybe even win the game. Paul Pogba was at the center of everything. And Mason Greenwood scores. But generally speaking, Southampton were pretty comfortable. Southampton had the best chance of the second half, which was Armstrong's. Like, that's a miss to me. I know it's a good save, but he's 1v1 with De Gea. He just needs to slot it low, and he hits it at a nice height, and De Gea comes up with a big save. I thought De Gea had a good game too. Mm. But United just no control in the middle of the park, Andrew. Like, again, it was... I mean, Matic and Fred, McTominay came on. Adam Crafton, the Athletic, tweeted this, and I've been thinking about this for months. Like, I'm not saying he's the answer to everything or maybe even anything, but if you're Donny van de Beek and you're on the sideline again for that game, like, what must you be thinking? And apparently we've heard he's worked really hard in preseason, and, you know, he's got to get out of the club. I mean, it's just amazing to me. And even Pogba talking afterwards, like, Solskjaer set a record at the weekend with this 1-1 draw. They went the whole of last season without losing a league game on the road, and this result on the South Coast took their unbeaten league away run to 27 matches, putting them level with Arsenal's Invincibles of 03-04. And Pogba was asked about it afterwards, and he was almost embarrassed to talk about it because it's a record that means literally nothing. He said it's about winning the Premier League. And like, in that 27-game period, they haven't come close to doing it. It's amazing to me. United have players to come back into the side, that's true. But it's amazing to me how Solskjaer hasn't just kind of... I was listening to Mark Lawrenson, who talked about, why is he playing two holding midfielders in there? Why doesn't he just go with one? I kind of agree with that too. But they have very little control in this side in midfield, Andrew. And as long as they don't, like, when they get on top in games, like they did for 15 minutes against 20 minutes against Southampton, they've got to close it out, or it's always likely that this kind of result will happen to them. And again, it comes down to the manager, because you look at the players they finished with on the field. Sancho, Bruno Fernandes, Pogba, you know.
That's the thing. Like,
Mason,
I know,
Greenwood, come on. I believe more in this side than a lot of Manchester United fans who keep making excuses for the manager here. Like, the buck stops with him on this.
Yeah, I know the point you were kind of making there. I mean, you said it quickly. It wasn't your main point, but you mentioned that, you know, they do still have players that have to come back into the squad. And I don't know, like I said that earlier about Arsenal. I think it's different when you're talking about Arsenal against Chelsea. I think in a situation like that, yeah, not having 5-6 of your first 11, that matters. I don't know, for Manchester United against Southampton, no offense to Southampton, but when Bruno Fernandes, when all those guys that you just mentioned are out there, I have no tolerance basically for, they still have, like, you know, Rashford was missing. Okay. He's a great player, but doesn't matter.
Rashford's
like,
not getting
matter.
In that team. Are you taking out Mason Greenwood to put in Marcus Rashford? Not in a million years. I'm not swapping anyone out for that. I think United have a team that are playing way below the level of the players that they have. And so you got to look at the coach.
Yeah. I suppose that's true. And we'll see what happens in the coming weeks, but he just got a new contract, so he's not going anywhere.
Oh, they have signed into this project. Also, I think it was Duncan Alexander tweeted that you are never more than 25 yards away from a Chelsea loan signing. And Tino Livramento was, I thought he was brilliant for Southampton at the weekend. And I think he's only 18.
Great run he had he set up Adam Armstrong, or just missed him, I guess, with his ball, but had a great run in the first half.
Generally a really good performance from Southampton. And, you know, I think that was a really, Hasenhüttl was very pleased at the end of the game, and he should be, because, you know, losing 3-1 away to Everton in the manner that they did after being a goal up probably didn't feel very good last weekend. So it was nice to steady the ship with this against what's supposed to be a top quality side.
So are Chelsea loanees kind of like the soccer world's version of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon?
It seems that way. I mean, we're seeing rumors today on a few football websites that Tejan Buchanan, Canada's own, is going to be on his way to Chelsea for $10 million US dollars. And you said immediately to me off air, you said, is he just going to be loaned out then? I don't know.
I'm sure he will.
Disappointing if that's the case.
He might be loaned right back to New England. Just have him finish out the season, and then, I don't know, I guess he'll join up after that. I don't know. A couple other things from the weekend, JJ. I know one of the talking points that's starting to emerge is, and you kind of touched on it earlier, what referees are allowing. I know Jurgen Klopp had some comments on it. I know we were just talking about Man United. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had some comments on it. This is now becoming a thing early in the season here.
Yeah, the topic of the moment, Andrew, the topic du jour, as the French probably wouldn't say, I feel like it's going to be the phrase of the season. Let the game flow. And it's the directive that referees are clearly taking to their bosoms. Maybe Burnley's not the best team to be talking about afterwards, as Burnley play like Burnley, as Klopp mentioned. But Klopp had some comments, as he always seems to have these days. This is what he said. You saw these challenges between Barnes and Wood and Virgil. I'm not 100% sure if we're going in the right direction with these kind of decisions. It feels like we are going back 10, 15 years and saying, well, that is the kind of football we wanted to see. It is just too dangerous. The rules are like they are, but you cannot defend these situations. It makes the game really tricky. They are the most difficult to defend. I'm not sure I like all the decisions in favor of the offensive team. That is fine, like offside, but we have to stick to protecting the players. We cannot deny that. You cannot say that's a challenge. I love watching that. Watch wrestling if you like these kinds of things. And Solskjaer, who was upset in the lead up to the Southampton goal, I think it was Bruno Fernandes, who I actually had no problem with this.
I thought he got hacked on that.
No, I watched it again. I think it was okay. I think, I can't remember who the player was, steps in front of him and wins the ball. And but okay, whatever. So this is what Solskjaer had to say. We cannot go from one extreme like basketball last season into rugby now. I like the more lenient interpretation. It's more like men's football, but that is a clear foul. Okay, right. Let's not debate that particular foul. All right. You can have your opinion on that. What these managers are saying is very interesting to me, because if I'm Jurgen Klopp and I have the kind of midfield, which is a high energy pressing midfield that wants to get opposition players with their back facing their own goal, winning balls and nipping in and taking them. Oftentimes, some of those tackles are on the edge a little bit. They're just, if I'm Jurgen Klopp, the new leniency, particularly with midfield challenges, is something I would be. Now, I know he's talking more about challenges with the center backs, but that's Burnley. That's the way Burnley always play. Burnley aren't going to be any different. In fact, Sean Dyche after the game thought there was too many soft free kicks given. So if I'm Jurgen Klopp, I'm not sure Burnley is the best example.
Yeah,
no,
but
I understand what he means.
You're right, but Klopp is worried, though. He's not thinking about his press. Like he's worried of how, because he knows what his team is. They're an attack-minded team that wants to fly against their opponent. He's afraid of what teams are going to do to stop that.
You a very good point too, but I do think there's a flip side to that coin. And I do think the kind of challenges in the midfield to get quick turnovers and put the opposition on the back foot, this leniency will actually help Jurgen Klopp and help Liverpool. I'm going to go on record. I wonder if it'll play out like that. It may not.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll be honest, as a fan, if I'm deciding between, and look, I know there's a middle ground, I get that. But if I'm deciding between a lot of things being called and more leniency in the way of what's being called, I'd take this. I think I would take this.
I 100% agree with you. Michael Calley tweeted this. I don't know who was watching football last season and thought there's not enough violence in midfield. Let's make one third of fouls legal, but it creates a whole lot of exciting chaos, I guess. And that is probably the point.
Yeah.
When people like the aforementioned Graeme Souness talk about our league, you know, the great thing about our league, you know, that kind of commentary. This is the kind of stuff they're talking about, robust, meaty challenges. And they're back in, Andrew. Whether you like it or not, they're back.
Yep. Let's see. A couple other things, JJ. Danny Ings.
Andrew, just give him the Puskas now.
You think so?
Oh,
think
hand that's it to him. I enjoyed it so much.
I'm not ready to do that. Come on. Look, he's the leader in the clubhouse so far, at least for goal of the season. I don't know about Puskas. I mean, that's...
Yeah, no. Maybe I need to calm down. There was probably a goal scored in Malaysia that is just going to blow my mind. Actually, I take that back. I think it was Atletico Mineiro in Brazil scored a better goal than Danny Ings's, if you can believe it.
I'll take your word for it. But yeah, it's so far, if we're talking goal of the season, you know, I'm always preparing for the Devonlings. I have a rolling document with my awards. And right now, leader in the clubhouse. That's what I'll give him. It was a brilliant goal. Certainly was. Yeah. Nice start for him. Two goals in 2 weeks for Danny Ings at Villa.
Yeah, excellent start. And people are already getting on top of me for what I said in the preview, where I thought he might be overpriced. I thought it was a lot of money for a guy who's clocking on towards 30 and has had a history of injuries. So that's been used against me now after he just scores a bicycle kick in the second game of the season.
It was a wretched opinion when you gave it. but like we always say, our predictions only matter when they're right. So I've actually stricken it from the record. So you can rest easy.
Kind of.
JJ, Tottenham and Wolves, wanted to just mention a couple things from this. Obviously, Nuno made his return to the Molyneux. It was almost weird when they would show like the angle, like the camera angle kind of behind Nuno, and you could see the stands at Wolves behind him. And you almost had these moments where you forgot he was managing the other team. Like, it just looks so natural to see him there in that stadium. But he goes back, gets a win. Dele Alli converting a penalty after he drew the penalty with some craftiness, I would say, in drawing that foul, kind of left that leg dangling to ensure contact. But that's what you're supposed to do, right?
No, that's the kind of penalty we're not supposed to have this season.
Well, he got it.
That was one of them. Well, yeah, and that's the problem. That is the issue. That's the issue that Arsenal fans are boiling bodily fluids over this. They were upset that they didn't get their penalty, but that Dele Alli did.
Consistency. It's all we ask for. Consistency. And yet we never seem to find it. So a couple things from this game. First off, Harry Kane came on as a sub. Played the last 20 minutes for Tottenham. And I was, as a Tottenham fan myself, who has been conflicted on this one, I was so curious as to how he would be received by the away fans, the Spurs supporters that had traveled there. And he was received with open arms. He's one of our own. You could hear it. And then you heard the Wolves fans responding with a kind of contradictory chant to that. But the Tottenham fans, they applauded him. And then Harry Kane, after the game, he acknowledged that and he applauded the traveling supporters that were there. So he's back. All is well, JJ.
Look, there seems to be maybe some kind of realization that City aren't going to meet Daniel Levy's price. Now, the big question is, why won't they do that? I think it's to maintain at least, you know, this is a team that's been, the FFP spotlight has been on them quite seriously for the last few years, and even more intensely over the summer with the Daily Mail article. And so, you know, spending a $250 million on two players is going to raise questions. And I think whatever they're trying to do, I think I wouldn't be shocked if City are trying to offload some players as part of the Kane deal, and Levy doesn't want that. He wants straight cash money, yo.
I think, you know what? I'm not even going to make a prediction. I have no idea how this is going to play out. I have no clue.
Do you think eventually, like maybe this drags on a little bit longer and that it happens either at the end of this window or in the winter window?
It will not happen in the winter. That would surprise me more than anything. It's very like Daniel Levy to allow this to go till the 11th hour. So I shouldn't be surprised by that. However, if it does, I'm preemptively angry about it, because now Tottenham will be left with a treasure chest of cash that they'll be able to do nothing with to fix themselves and make up for his loss. And so that will be frustrating unless Tottenham spend before then. There's talk about them really ramping up their interest in Adama Traore, who was excellent in this game. Although, God, if he could only finish, the player he would be.
Andrew, I would not touch that. I would not touch that. I would not do that to you. Not in a million years.
Okay.
He's one of those players. I think there's a lot going on there in terms of, I just don't think he's the finished product, and I'm not sure he ever will be. We're always just waiting for him to get a consistent run. And I mean, don't forget, Nuno left him out of the side last season as well, plenty of times. And now he wants to bring him to Tottenham. What's going to change?
Clearly Nuno thinks something of him if he wants him back.
I mean, too, but I've yet to see.
Well, we saw it two years ago. Step up. 2 years ago, we saw it. And then last year, it seemed like he plateaued or even regressed. If what we saw yesterday is any indication of what he's going to be this season, then I think we're seeing the 2 year ago version of Traore. It's very early. And again, like I said, he still can't finish, but boy, can he create. So I would be intrigued by that with him on the wing. But you know, we'll have to see. One other thing on Tottenham and transfers. So now we're hearing more about Tanguy and Ndombele just not wanting to play for Tottenham. And I can tell you, as I have an irrational love of that guy, and I'm so disappointed with how this is ending. There's a lot of Tottenham fans that probably could care less, but I am not one of those. I think he's a potentially brilliant player. And if this winds up never coming to fruition, this will be one that stews with me for a long time. I will be angry about this irrationally to a certain extent. I will be angry about this for a long time if he leaves. Just putting that out there.
Yeah, the amount of promise that he entered the club with and the way things have panned out, partly because he came at the wrong time with the wrong manager and Jose Mourinho, but it's just not been good. It's not been good at all, Andrew. Sorry.
And then finally, JJ, on the Premier League, Jack Grealish scored his first goal for Manchester City as they go off, put five past Norwich. And I guess now they're off and running after a rough start the first week.
Yeah, and whatever happens this season, I think City will do that to they'll do that to quite a few teams. And yeah, there's not much to say about that one, except, you know, feel bad for Norwich. This was their start to the season, Liverpool and then Manchester City. Hmm. They're a better team than the last 2 weeks, and I'm sure they'll start picking up points soon.
That goal differential is it's in a bad place after two games.
It certainly is. It certainly is. I say I'm sure they'll start picking up points soon. I'm not sure of anything, but I think they are better than... it's unfortunate to start the season with two powerhouse teams.
Yeah, certainly is when you're newly promoted. Welcome back, Norwich. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break, JJ. On the other side, we're going to talk about what happened in Ligue 1 with Nice and Marseille. We're going to talk about Cristiano Ronaldo. And you have a mailbag, which I should tell you, I have not looked at any of them. So be prepared for a lot of stuttering and stammering or just instinctive answers that make little to no sense. It should really be interesting.
Look, Andrew, you're on vacation, and the fact you're doing this podcast just shows your commitment to the pod. So I will excuse the fact that you wouldn't even open the mailbag this week.
Well, when did you send it? I looked at the rundown yesterday. There was nothing. It said to
I sent it this morning. We were coagulating. We were tabulating. We were getting more of feedback from our listeners. You got to give this thing time to percolate. And the fact you didn't even just have give it a quick scan suggests there's deeper problems for you, my friend.
You're a monster. Every time that the mailbag has been prepared, you always email it to me. There was no message letting me know it was ready. I sit down to start the podcast thinking, I guess he doesn't have one today. Next thing I know, I scroll down. It's all there.
I did change tactics a little bit. Maybe it's my fault. There was a systems failure. I did add it to the Google Sheet. So maybe that's my problem.
I don't like it one bit. You're set out on a mission to embarrass me. And we'll find out if you achieve that objective. Let's take a break. We'll be back with a lot more. Don't go anywhere. Oh, back now. Caught offside. Ligue 1. Nice, Marseille. So about 15 minutes to go in the game. And this is in Nice, Marseille trailing, and Marseille are preparing for a corner kick. Something, a water bottle, some projectile is thrown at Dimitri Payet, and he has had it. It hit him. I saw a picture of him afterwards, and there's like a welt on his back. Like it made contact. He had been getting it from certain differing reports. You hear that it wasn't the first thing thrown at him or Marseille players during this game. That place was a cauldron. And so Payet had absolutely had it, you could see, and he did the thing probably that Nice fans wanted him to do. He picked up the water bottle, launched it back at the crowd. More was thrown at him. He threw all of it back, and I say Nice fans wanted it because you could it, sometimes, like I was watching Superbad recently, JJ, one of my all-time favorite movies, and there's a scene before like they're at this house party and a fight is about to go down. And they consent. There's this group of guys having like a cocaine party in a back room. And they're basically looking at each other saying, there's going to be a fight tonight. I know it. I've been sitting here praying for a fight. I literally wake up in the morning and I am praying for a fight. That was the sense that I got from these Nice fans, that they just wanted something to go down. And so when Payet threw that water bottle back into the crowd, that was sort of the ignition switch. Next thing you know, Nice ultras are streaming onto the field. There are confrontations with players, security, players of both teams. I should say that Nice's own players seem to be battling their fans to get off the pitch. Security is ushering away Marseille players frantically, trying to hold back these fans that have stormed onto the pitch. So Marseille players, we fast forward a little bit. They're escorted back to their locker room. And a while later, Ligue 1, and they're going to try to resume the game. Marseille refuses to come back out. And the ball is played in a surreal scene. The ball is placed for the corner kick that was supposed to have been taken before all this went down. Nice places the ball there, waiting for Marseille's players to come out. They never do. The referee blows the game dead. And I have not read, JJ, that's kind of where my knowledge on this ends. I don't know what has been decided since then. Either Nice were leading 1-0 at the time. And so there's talk about, okay, how is this going to end? And here is what I don't know heading into this. I do not know the exact way to handle this. Here is what I do know. Forfeiting Marseille ain't it. There are three options here. You either pick it up in the 75th minute and play the rest of this game behind closed doors at some point, or you replay the entire match behind closed doors at some point, or you forfeit Nice. Because, like, I don't care that Payet threw that water bottle back into the stands. I don't care about that. Players have to be protected. That's the bottom line. It may have been wrong that he did it, but a message has got to be sent here that fans cannot act like animals. And handing Nice a win of any kind, whether it be shutting it down and just giving them the 1-0, forfeiting them, which becomes a 3-0 win for Nice, that ain't it. There's got to be a stronger message sent than that. And so giving Nice a victory here, just to me, it's the one thing that cannot be allowed to happen.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. There was also unverified photos of Matteo Guendouzi and Luan Perez with strangle marks on their necks, according to the Associated Press. I mean, this was absolutely crazy. As it stands right now, there's no ruling being made. So, guys, don't jump on us. We don't know yet. As we're recording, we don't know. But technically, that is supposed to be, because Marseille didn't come back out, that is technically supposed to be 3-0 to Nice.
Right. And I'm saying that can't be allowed to happen.
That cannot happen.
Sends the worst possible message.
Also,
because we've talked about, since the pandemic ended, here in the United States too, at NBA arenas, during the NBA playoffs, like, we have seen fans that have bottled up some sort of energy, and it's come out in some great ways with great atmospheres and all that, but it's also come out in some terrible ways. And we're seeing it a little, we saw it, like we said, at the European Championship final at Wembley. We saw it here in Nice, and like, there's gotta be some guardrail put to this. Like, there's some message has to be sent. And yeah, Nice, like, if they play this game again and Nice wins, fine. Like, then they win the game. But like, it can't end here with a Nice victory.
I think Nice as a football club need to be fined, because the stewards and the security there, I mean, those fans had to come. If you look at where the stand is, they had a distance to travel before they got to the field. Not a huge distance, but enough that they should have been stopped before they got to the grass. And it was a bad job there. Yeah, I can't see any other way around this other than that it's weighted towards Marseille one way or the other, because they definitely are the victim in this case.
You are right with what you're saying about, because you're right, there's a little bit of a gap between that stand behind the goal and the field itself. However, I'll give a little bit of leniency to stadium security in the situation, because ultimately, what are we talking here? I mean, like, I'm not saying that, like, how many people are in that stand behind the goal?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, if that group of people decides we're getting on the field, then what, like, how much security can you possibly have? Like,
there is definitely a unwritten social contract in modern stadia that we're not going to have fences. We're not going to have dangerous things that can cause crushes. Mm-hmm. But you are also going to stay in your damn seat.
Right, right.
There is definitely that. Most pitches are, we saw that piece of video from MLS where the child just hurdles, this little infant hurdles the barrier and toddler starts running onto the field and the mom has to go after him. Right. And it was like, it was no problem, easily done. So yes, there is that. And I don't want to come down too hard on security, but in a lot of leagues, there is a, how should we put it? There is a law that says the control of your fans in your stadium, you know, it is your responsibility as a football club and you will get fined for it.
Right. And you're right. They should be fine. That's true. But I just don't want to, I don't want to make it sound like security that, I mean, I guess if fans wound up on the field there, then a failure of some sort happened. I just feel bad putting it on them because I just don't, I almost, in watching the video of it, I was almost relieved with the number of fans that wound up on there because you felt like once the floodgates open, oh my God, how is this going to end? How many people are going to empty out onto that field and cause mayhem? And it wound up probably not being nearly as many as what it could have been. But the fact that it happened at all, the fact that Ligue 1 is now dealing with this, the fact that various Marseille players, like you said, I saw the welt on Payet's back. You talked about Guendouzi. You know, the fact that Marseille had to go through this. Yeah, Nice, it's their stadium. They need to be held responsible. So you're right. There should be a fine, but that's a tough spot for security, man.
Like I said, sorry to interrupt, Andrew. We've got no knowledge of what conclusion Ligue 1 and the powers that be are going to come to. But there is breaking news. Jordan Shaqiri joins Lyon.
Whoa!
In a £9.5 million pounds sterling deal. So that's what, $10-11 million. So that is Jordan Shaqiri's period at Liverpool is over. Premier League winners medal, World Club Cup medal, and also a European Champions League winners medal. So interesting period. It never quite worked. He certainly didn't get the game time he would have wanted. But if anyone wants to take a look back and watch the game that he played against Barcelona, he made a lot of mistakes in that famous 4-0 night. He was probably the player that you were like, I wish he'd settled down, stop giving the ball away. But he did put the cross in for one of the goals. And he's had some contributions the last few years for sure.
Well, we said about him after the Euros that, you know, because he had another successful Euros with the Swiss. And so we said the time is now. Like, he's not going to be whatever he thought he might be when he went to Liverpool, any kind of focal point or consistent starter. Clearly that ship had sailed and wasn't going to happen, but he's, you know, of an age where like, it's kind of now or never. If you want to be that guy on a team, you got to go. And so this Lyon move had been talked about for a while. And, you know, I'm kind of excited for him to see it go through. Cause I think he's a good player and maybe not good enough to break through and be a regular starter for Liverpool, but he can certainly do a good job for Lyon. So good for him. I think it's a good move for everyone.
Right. We should do Ronaldo quickly. Cause we got a mailbag that you haven't seen. And this is going to be carnage.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of silence, a lot of stoppages during this mailbag. So Ronaldo, does he want to leave Juventus? Does he want to stay at Juventus? Gab Marcotti, I would recommend everybody check out his article at ESPN FC where he kind of goes through the complexities of this and whether like who is trying to play who here, who is leaking information just to gauge reaction. Like, this is I don't know, or are we just reading too much into all of this? Where it seems, JJ, that Ronaldo, a report may have been leaked to to Edu Aguirre of El Chiringuito, who apparently is close to Ronaldo, and he had a report of Ronaldo potentially heading back to Real Madrid. No,
I did not see that.
Okay. Well, I think that was it. And Ronaldo
that could possibly, he denied it, right?
Right. He denied it. But then there's been all this talk because in Gab's article, he basically says that Edu Aguirre of Il Chiringuito is not just some journalist. Go through his Instagram. He is incredibly close with Cristiano Ronaldo. There are a number of pictures of them together in non-business settings. So he's not just some guy. So Ronaldo denied it. And it leads to the question of, oh, like, is this friendship between these two guys finished? Or is this all just part of some act where leaked intentionally? And then Ronaldo is putting the kibosh on it to try to save face in some way. But
no,
he
it's
really
just
does
to get
want
it,
to, yeah,
it's to get it out there.
Yeah.
It's the first way to break with Juventus is to have them be aware that there is something going on here. And it his friend takes the hit. He asked his friend to do it. I would say that's the way it went. I mean, we're talking about good sources. Fabrizio Romano had this. He tweeted this yesterday. Cristiano Ronaldo will be on the bench for Udinese Juventus. Official, he's not starting. It was a precise request from Cristiano because he hopes to find a solution on the market in the next days. But Juventus have received no official bids for Cristiano. So this is just a way of him getting out. Hey, guys, you know, if anybody wants to talk to me, I'm available to be spoken to. Now, the problem is the timing is dreadful. Like, where can he go? There is only one place possibly that he can go. And that would be back to Real Madrid, but can they afford him? Probably not. It would take a lot of financial acrobatics to get that done. And I don't think anybody else is going to be interested at those wages, at that price. So,
yeah.
And it'd be, I'm sure the officials at Serie A want him to stay. I would be fairly confident they do, considering some of the TV deals they've just signed. And then to lose him right at the start of the season would not be good. But he did come off the bench and create on-field drama. He scored what he thought would be the winning goal from a header, Andrew, against Udinese. But VAR, of course, intervened. So that's a 2-2 draw away at Udinese for Juventus to start the season with.
Yeah. I'm interested by this, certainly. I mean, look, it's Ronaldo, of course. But like he's Ronaldo apparently is very close also with Carlo Ancelotti, who's at Real Madrid now. So it just feels like the wind is blowing in that direction. But like you said, there's a lot of financial gymnastics that will be at work here. Not to mention, like, we can't just forget some of the comments that Florentino Perez had made about Ronaldo, whether or not Ronaldo cares enough about that, where he's just wants to be back there and like, whatever, Florentino, you go do what you do, stay out of my way and we'll be fine here. You know, so this is an interesting one. I don't know how this one ends.
Yet another saga. Add it to the list, Andrew.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see. What is he? 37?
He's not 37. Why are you aging Ronaldo?
I thought he was. I'm going to look it up now.
No, you're right. He's 36. He turns 37 in February.
Okay. So he'll be 37 this season. So like, I think that in some ways can at least limit what his transfer fee will be. But you still have to pay those wages. I mean, he's on what, like 80 million a year. So like, good luck with that. But I think the transfer fee itself, I think, could wind up being manageable, not extreme. But yeah, it's still a huge amount of money that you're going to have to come up with to make him work in that
spot.
Before
we get off it, Jonathan Wilson has posted a article to Sports Illustrated Online with the very canny title of "No Clubs for Older Men." There is a confluence of factors that leaves accomplished yet aging stars like Cristiano Ronaldo without much of a market in the transfer window. Pretty much what we've been saying right now.
There you go. All right, here we go, baby. It's mailbag time.
CaughtOffsidePod@gmail.com. CaughtOffside ESPN on Instagram and @CSoccerPod on Twitter. Follow us. Give us a rating on iTunes. Give us a rating wherever you can give us a rating. We start with Kyle Dawson. I've only been following soccer for 8-ish years. When was the last time a massive club got relegated from the Premier League? And could that happen to Arsenal or some other club this season? I will allow you to deal with the latter half of the question. I will deal with the first half. So, of the old order established big sides, don't get upset with me. These are the old order established big sides. Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Everton. None of those have been relegated in the Premier League era. Manchester United went down in 1973-74 under Tommy Docherty in the old first division. Of the next tier, the Chelsea and Man Cities, Chelsea have never been relegated in the Premier League era. They were relegated in 1987-88 from the old first division. So relatively recently, but not since the Premier League era and impossible in the Abramovich era. City were relegated regularly in both the Premier League and the pre-Premier League era before being bought by Abu Dhabi. And so the last time they went down was actually pretty recent, 2001, they went down. Leeds United being relegated in 03-04 was the last massive club to go down, as a couple of seasons prior, they had been a Champions League semi-final. Now, Leeds had been down in the 80s in the old second division. That's true. But a club of their stature and a club that had just so recently been in Champions League final, for them to go down and to fall as far down as they did, that's the last big club I can think of. Nottingham Forest, yes, but Forest have been down now for 20-something years, and Sheffield Wednesday don't qualify in this massive club kind of, this massive club ring fencing job that I've created here myself. Villa going down was big too, but they'd experienced it before in the 1980s. In fact, not long after winning the European Cup themselves. So yeah, Leeds United is really your last big club in England that went down.
And I felt like Newcastle going down was a big deal.
Newcastle going down, yeah, but I suppose Newcastle went down twice in how many 5 years or something like that.
The first time they went down, that was shocking to me. Yeah, that felt like something you don't normally see.
Okay, that's a fair point. And Newcastle had been a team that, at least in the 90s and in the early 2000s under Kevin Keegan and Sir Bobby Robson, respectively, had been in Champions League football and had been competing for Premier League. So yeah, actually, I give you that one. I should have included Newcastle in this. Can you please deal with the second half of this?
Well, being one other thing,
I'm not throwing you in.
One other thing you didn't mention, you left Tottenham out of that. I don't think you included them in any of your tiers. They have, for whatever tier you put them in, they have not been relegated since 76, 77, I believe. So there's that also.
I should have included it. They should be in the next tier of newer good clubs. Okay. Yeah, apologies.
In terms of whether or not Arsenal will be relegated this season, I will go on record now, and if I'm wrong, then so be it. But they're not getting relegated. They're not getting relegated. So
I don't think they will either, but I don't think that they are beyond being in that kind of flexible mush that happens from like ninth position down to like 15th or 16th.
If they get relegated, then to me, it almost goes into the category of my surprise, like when Leicester won the title. I'll almost be that surprised.
All right.
Put it that way.
That's fair. Right.
All right.
Andrew, sometimes there are topics that light up our inbox and social media and you just can't ignore it. It incenses people. It gets them angry. This one literally could have opened the show this week. In fact, I was almost thinking, because I didn't really think Chelsea and Arsenal was that good of a game, I nearly thought we'd do this. So Puma last week dropped a load of something, in some people's opinions, a third kit. I've never seen a third kit make so much waves. Basically, this third kit is not a very traditional kit of any sort, in that the crest has been removed. There's no crest. The crest is kind of a faded kind of motif in the background, but it's not a prominent crest. Mm-hmm. You can't really see it. And in front, they've written the team name, and underneath that is a sponsor. They look really, really, first of all, the first thing they do is you've got to have a crest. The crest is the centerpiece of the club. It doesn't matter if the crest is faded in the background and you can see it. That's not good enough. The crest has to be prominent. There is none. And the second thing, it just looks so cheap. It looks like a fake jersey that you buy on holiday at a stand that also sells hot dogs. They're so bad.
So I don't like them. I, for the life of me, I don't understand. Like that's just poor market research, I would say, to think we can put these out without a visible crest on them. Like, know your audience, know how that will play. So yeah, I'm on board with that. I will say this about them. Those of us with American brains will not necessarily hate seeing the actual name of the team across the front of the jersey.
But it just looks so like, and there's a problem as well. There's like the font of the team
is smaller than the sponsor.
The branded font of the other team, which just doesn't look right. Like Fenerbahce's one with Avis on it. It's just so ugly.
Yeah. I don't like how these, like, I would not, I always say my general gauge with kits is if I saw that in a club store, would I buy it? The answer for these is no, I would not buy these. But yeah, again, I don't hate that the name of the team is on the front. I just don't like, I don't know. I just, no, the way that it wound up looking, I just don't think they did it right.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone said that it looks as if the people at Puma were told you've got an hour to design a kit, a third kit, please get doing it now. Also, there was a very funny moment when a Fenerbahce player scored last weekend, or was it this weekend? In the last few days anyway. And he wheels away to celebrate and he looks down. He like picks his jersey up in the classic way where you'd go to kiss the crest.
Right.
And then he looks around and can't find the crest. It's all part of his celebration, which was really quite something.
Yeah.
Gosh, pitcher. What's up, JJ and Andrew? How cool was it to see two American coaches facing one another in the Bundesliga this weekend? A German league with two American coaches. Never thought I would have seen the day. Yeah, very true. So Pellegrino Matarazzo versus Jesse Marsch. Stuttgart versus RB Leipzig. A 4-0 win for Jesse Marsch. But it's also... this is good, by the way, because I don't think we should always pay attention to this, but the credibility factor for American soccer did have a kind of a hole in it without a major coach of note operating in the European leagues. And now that we have that, I do think that it's a good thing. But this is also Wayne, New Jersey versus Princeton University. And it further cements the fact that New Jersey is the soccer home of the United States.
Wow.
They should change it from the Garden State and write New Jersey, home of U.S. soccer.
Or just the soccer state.
The soccer state. Yeah, absolutely. It's you look at the amount of players Jersey produces, how competitive the leagues are within Jersey, the amount of participation, California and New Jersey. Maybe there's other really good states. Texas, Virginia have unbelievable soccer cultures. But I think New Jersey is the soccer state.
I could go along with that. Isn't Bob Bradley's from New Jersey, right?
Yes, and Carly Lloyd that recently retired.
Yeah. All right, I'll run with that.
Jonathan Sanchez has picked up on something. Well, he didn't pick up on it. He experienced something that I have questions about too. Why did it take almost 3 hours of a weather delay for the refs to realize the field was unplayable for the Hudson River Derby, NYCFC versus Red Bull New York? That was announced over the loudspeakers. It was raining really hard for a few hours already. Couldn't the grounds crew and league officials made that determination earlier? Should there be a strict policy for weather-related delays? This is from MLSsoccer.com. Saturday evening's New York Derby between the New York Red Bulls and NYCFC has been postponed due to an unplayable field at Red Bull Arena in Harrison, New Jersey. Kickoff originally scheduled for 8:25 p.m. Eastern time was delayed for more than 2 hours due to severe weather in that area. A revised kickoff time was then determined, but the on-site match officials determined that the field was not safe to play. Why not just look at the weather and just can it? Like, I've seen this before where there's been thunder showers and games have been interrupted in the middle of the game and supporters are just left hanging around waiting for a restart. I've been at games a few years ago. It was an NYCFC versus Colorado game at Yankee Stadium and it got delayed twice because of thunder and lightning. It's just ridiculous. Fans always suffer with this. And this one was an easy one to call.
Yes.
Because we were in the midst of a massive... rainstorm of a hurricane, tropical storm moving in. Just give the fans a chance to get home and not have them hanging around 3 hours of a weather delay and fans wondering what's going to happen. It's just not right. It's contemptuous.
Yeah, it's unacceptable. And you know, like, look, I've seen both sides of it with baseball, but I think to compare it to baseball this past weekend in New York, I believe the Yankees preemptively canceled their Sunday game on Saturday because they knew what was coming. So like there, like you said, there were no surprises here with that weather. And I saw the pictures. There's kind of that famous video that's been circulating on Twitter of the match official trying to kick the ball at the center circle. And like, he kicks it with force, like to the point where the ball probably should roll. Like if it was a normal field, the ball could potentially roll somewhere from like 15 to 20 yards with how hard he kicks it. JJ goes like 3 feet. Like the ball does not move. So yeah, this, like, you didn't need 3 hours. If you didn't, like, you could have canceled this ahead of time, knowing with what was coming, but
of
fine.
Of course you could.
But like, fine. You play soccer, can play through the rain. So we're going to give it a go, but you did not need 3 hours. 1 hour, maybe less, was sufficient to know we're not playing soccer tonight. So yeah, I feel bad for those fans, and I'm sure, like, so what, like, what's the conspiracy though, that like, we're going to keep this open so people continue to consume alcohol and buy food and buy stuff, and like, and we're going to, you know, we're going to play the game at all because we want people to pay for parking, whether or not it's anywhere as malicious as what it sounds like a calculated, I don't know that that's true. But when you do something like this, you open yourself up to fans feeling that way, that they're being used so you can line your pockets again. Yeah. That may not be true, but that's the sort of blowback that you get when this stuff happens.
100%. I was at Red Bull Arena on Wednesday night for the Columbus Crew game. I enjoyed it so much. There isn't a bad seat in the house in that place.
I love that place, yeah.
Yeah, no, look, 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night, it's not good. You're not going to fill it, and it wasn't close to being full. I mean, I would say if there was 8,500, they did well, which is really poor. But the hardcore Red Bull fans that were there are brilliant, man. They love this team. And I hate when fans are being exploited or, you know, just made to wait around. You could have done them a favor, and you could have really looked after them in this instance at the weekend.
Yeah.
One breaking news note.
Oh boy.
From the LA Times. US women's national team star Kristen Press becomes the first player to sign with Angel City FC, which is going to be the new team, which will play next season. Our own Kathleen McNamee said sources with knowledge of the deal told the LA Times it will make her one of the highest paid players in NWSL history.
Wow.
So Angel City really deciding that we are going to make a splash and make sure we're known from the get-go, and we're going to pay a big, big fee.
Good for them, and good for her. Well deserved.
Indeed.
There you go. Is that it for the mailbag?
That is the mail beezy. Thanks to everyone who contributed this week, and we'll have another one next week. We'll have quite a busy week next week, Andrew. We got to plan that out with the international break hitting us right in the face.
Yeah, it really is. I know sometimes that's the international break in particular that sometimes bothers people the most, because it's just as you're really getting momentum going on the domestic seasons. Nope, not this time. I am extremely excited for this to happen. It is World Cup qualifying time. The road back to redemption begins next week. I cannot wait.
And look, it's been a fabulous summer. It's been very enjoyable to pick up two trophies in the summer against your biggest rival. I'm not for a second telling you that the great feelings you had weren't exactly that great feelings. But those feelings will be gone. They will be washed away, like so much garbage was in Brooklyn, by the storms of rain that is World Cup qualifying, if you don't get it done over the next year or so. So friends, the real, real stuff starts next week, and I hope you can join us for it.
What you say is true. Also, I don't care for your attitude in the way you've approached that.
That was
really negative. It almost sounded, if I didn't know any better, it almost sounded like you're rooting for it, like you're rooting for chaos. And I didn't care for that. I want a much more positive JJ next week.
I am very positive, but you know what? I'm positive, Andrew, that we got to get out.
All right. All right. Well, hey, this was fun. I enjoyed this thoroughly. Enjoy all the games throughout the course of the week and weekend. We'll be back, like we said, next week with another Caught Offside. Good stuff, my friend. To you, I say...
Check you later, fun boy.
See ya.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.
Ten seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/network.